the history and the meaning of the Appalachian Trail. It may seem as though the Appalachian Trail was always meant to be part of the American landscape. It is one of the most popular destinations in America. An estimated 4 million people hike at least part of it every year. But dig into its history, and you'll learn that the very fact it exists, a 2,000-mile footpath from Georgia to Maine, is remarkable. If not for the vision and dedication of a small handful of people, each of whom came at just the right time in American history, and each of whom worked tirelessly, there would be no such trail. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss the Appalachian Trail with the author of a new book about the people who created it. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Every year, millions of people hike all or part of the Appalachian Trail. Well, today we are going to learn about the remarkable history of the AT. My guest, Philip Denieri, who is a lecturer at the University of Michigan and author of the new book, The Appalachian Trail, a biography. As always, we invite your questions and comments. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Philip, thanks so much for joining us. I really enjoyed the book. And in your book, each chapter is the story of a person or people who played a critical role in the creation of the AT as it is today. These people are so interesting, and I do want to talk about them. But what I found even more fascinating is how the story of the Appalachian Trail really reflects these larger stories, stories about society, about nature, about the role of government, the power of bureaucracy, you know, social movements, creating mythologies. And I was wondering if you expected all that when you set out to write this book.
Yes and no. The reason that I wanted to write the book was that I wanted to look at the AT through the prism of why we create these places, what our motivations are, what needs we feel like we're serving. We make natural places to serve a certain set of, you know, wants, needs, requirements, ambitions that we have. And the AT is a good example of that. So I knew that that was what I was getting into when I started it. But getting to know these people better over the course of the research turned up, you know, just fascinating personalities and a set of motivations for these people that I didn't necessarily know a lot about ahead of time. And the hope is that if you get to know the people and what they were after when they did their bit on the Appalachian Trail, well, then you can get to know the place a little bit better. And hopefully the ambition of the book is that the AT is just one place. So if we can tell the story in this way about the AT, it kind of gives us insight into other places that we preserve.
Sure. And you've kind of hinted at this, that you came to this topic differently than other authors might. You're not an avid outdoors person. You didn't write this book after, for example, through hiking the trail.
Yeah, that's true. I am far from it. And I always try to make that clear to people from the start. And the reason that I felt okay doing that is that the AT and places like it, Acadia National Park, are places that we know about and care about and connect with, even if we don't spend a lot of time in there, in those places, even if we're not power users or through hikers. So I feel like the AT is a place that people certainly up and down the Eastern Seaboard, and in fact, across the country, and for many people across the world, it's a place they really connect with, whether or not they are the most avid users of it. And so there's great books out there told from the inside of the trail and the inside of the AT community. And I've got some of them listed on my website for people to learn more about. But I did feel like it's a place that the rest of us have a connection to as well. And it would be worth writing about it from that perspective.
Right. And just the idea of it is so important to so many people. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit. bit, but one of the many things that I've been thinking about is how the AT is an example of something we take for granted, but it very easily and most likely should not have happened, right? I mean, it's remarkable that the Appalachian Trail exists.
Yeah, you could say that it not only shouldn't have happened in the first place, but it also, you know, to use your expression, should have fallen apart and been abandoned multiple times since it was first built. So the first proposal for an AT was published almost exactly 100 years ago in November of 1921. The first version of the trail was completed in Maine in 1937. That took a tremendous organizational effort led by this man named Myron Avery. I don't think anybody expected it. Certainly the person who wrote the article proposing it, Benton Mackay, didn't expect it to happen that quickly. But even then, immediately after it was completed, a hurricane came through New England. Huge parts were blocked by downed trees. Nature overgrew sections of the trail. World War II happened. People's attention went elsewhere. So the whole thing had to be, large stretches of it, rerouted and rebuilt in the 1950s. It then faced the pressures of suburbanization in some places, vacation homes and ski resorts in other places. And it took a commitment by the federal government, which started in the 1970s, to then come in and protect the trail. So it has had several different versions over its history and several different places where it could have, not happened or been lost to us. It's now very substantially and rigorously protected, primarily by the National Park Service.
Right. So anybody who's a 25-year-old through hiker has only lived in this world where it was a protected national treasure. But people who maybe are older and have followed the history know otherwise. I want to go one by one through your chapters and talk about some of the people. I'm not even sure how to pronounce Arnold. Is it Guyot?
Guyot is how Guyot? I say it. I believe that's how a French speaker would say it.
And one of the things that struck me, Arnold Guyot is Swiss and he comes to America. He's a scientist. And he ends up going up into the mountains and mapping them. And that was seen as a little bit weird back then, right?
Oh, absolutely. For most of American history, European American history to that point, the backwoods and the mountains were a blank spot on the map. People either didn't care about them in the first place because they couldn't be farmed and settled. They were too high up. They were too steep. And they were just in the way of getting to the next place where people could do that. Can we get across the mountains to settle farther west? And the other thing is for much of our history, the mountains, the backwoods, the forests weren't just useless to that sort of conventional mindset, but were dangerous. They were places where there was no civilization, therefore there was no morality. And to go there was, seen as a dangerous thing, not just physically, but sort of morally. By the time you get to Guyot's time, the mid-1800s, the world is industrializing, science is advancing, our understanding of the world is moving ahead. And he's one of the first people who says, look, we can know this place from the inside out. We can measure it. We can map it. We can look at it as one singular mountain chain that, runs from almost the Gulf of Mexico in the south up to the Canadian Maritimes in the north. So he really filled in the blank spot on the map because he was of a time when we were transitioning away from our fear of nature and beginning to think of it as a restful place, a respite from the busy urban industrializing world.
And speaking of reflecting his time, so interesting that your chapter two, Horace Kephart, he reflected his time. I did not know that during this time in history, in the late 1800s, there was a real back to nature movement. And Kephart first joined it and then, was a little bit of a show person and sort of perpetuated it.
Yeah, again, as a response to urbanization and industrialization, people who lived in and benefited from that, the urban and suburban middle class, started to feel this longing for and this nostalgia for a backwoods that they, you know, both kind of remembered, but also for to a large extent invented for themselves. So Kephart was a librarian. He lived in a big city. He was very interested in camping and the outdoors. And he was one of the foremost writers of this early, you know, really beginning of the 1900s back to nature movement. He was a larger than life personality in a, you know, we have these terms nowadays for people who build their so-called personal brand. It's not language that I'm all that comfortable using, but we've got it. You know, certainly those kind of terms weren't around back then. But, you know, one way to think of him, Kephart, was that he was an early 20th century influencer, and he managed to make a career for himself out of it by writing magazine articles and crafting this persona, not all of which actually matched his day-to-day life. But, you know, this business of storytelling and how we see ourselves when we're in the woods, we all do that. And Kephart was a first great example of that.
So he wrote a book called Camping and Woodcraft, which was a great bestseller, but then a pamphlet called A National Park in the Great Smokies. And one could argue that that was the beginning of it all.
Yeah, the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, which we have today, along with Shenandoah National Park in Virginia, Great Smoky Mountains straddles the Tennessee-North Carolina border. Those were among, well, after Acadia, the first Eastern national parks. And what was different about Eastern national parks and national forests, for that matter, was they couldn't just be held back from settlement that the federal government had made possible. That's what happened in the West. The federal government takes the land from the natives for settlement, but we're going to hold these natural features back because they, you know, they're pretty and we want places to visit. In the East, you had to buy up those parcels because they already had people living in them. Timber companies owned them and were making money off of them. Kephart leads the way to create Great Smoky Mountains National Park, among others. Shenandoah is created at the same time. And both of those parks are bisected by and protect very long stretches of the AT, because the Appalachian Trail runs along the ridgeline of the mountains, and those parks are sort of centered around their mountain ranges.
All right, so next chapter. I'm drawing a blank on his first name, Taylor.
James P. Taylor.
And not here in Maine, but in Vermont. He's starting the movement, really, that I understand, not really starting the movement in New England, because also the Appalachian Mountain Club has been founded in 1876. But the idea of creating a trail that was a really long trail was, tell us about that.
Yeah. So the AMC, the Appalachian Mountain Club, based in Boston, had for years at that point been clearing and opening up trails, mostly in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, but elsewhere as well. So hiking as a pastime existed. But James P. Taylor, who when he started on this was a school teacher in Vermont, had this vision of connecting trails to the point where they become one big long distance trail. And because he got it started, to this day, there is the Long Trail in Vermont. It runs from the Massachusetts-Vermont border all the way up to the Vermont-Quebec border. And Taylor had a vision of trails not just as a place for rugged outdoors people to go enjoy themselves, but he had the idea that it could be the center of a civic project. You know, I was talking earlier about how the mountains were seen as wastelands. And believe it or not, in the early 1900s in Vermont, they viewed the Green Mountains as a burden. They divided the state in two on the east side and the west side. They couldn't be farmed. Vermont was emptying out of population at that point. People were leaving the farms to move to the cities. Taylor comes along and says, we could build a trail along the Green Mountain ridgeline with connections down into the towns, and this could be a source of renewal for our state and civic pride and a reason for people to visit. So he was really at the forefront of what I think many people think of Vermont and other New England states now as, you know, their natural beauty and their mountain getaways are, you know, what, you know, really define the state for a lot of folks and make it a very attractive place. So this idea that a trail isn't just a path through the woods for outdoors people, but it's something bigger, is something that Taylor put on the map. And then Benton Mackay, who invented the idea for the Appalachian Trail, you know, blew up from just the New England version of that all the way to the whole Appalachian mountain range.
Well, I love what, and going back to Taylor, really an early ecotourism proponent, even though, again, there wasn't a word like that back then. So Benton Mackay, fascinating person. And I'm going to read a little bit of what you wrote in the beginning of the chapter, because I thought this was fascinating. At the heart of Mackay's fraught relationship with the world was his peculiar way of understanding it. Where others saw objects and things, Mackay saw relationships, processes, and flows. A street was not just a collection of people and shops. It was a branch in the network of commerce, a collision of social interests, a catalyst for a different tomorrow. The woods were neither cuttable timber nor enjoyable scenery. They were the fountain of a just society and an honest culture. So fascinating that, as you say, Benton Mackay, the person who thought up the idea for the Appalachian Trail, really wasn't thinking about a scenic trail at all. He was thinking about these big thoughts about society and how we exist together in it.
Yeah. Mackay was certainly a big thinker, with all of the sort of pluses and minuses we might associate with that. He had, you know, fascinating, innovative thoughts about how cities and communities fit into and related to their natural surroundings. He saw it as all one system. Like any big thinker, on the one hand, he could put some really ideas out there that, you know, got people's attention and gave people something to chew on. He could also be a bit of a bore, and you know, his ideas were so big and so complex, and they came so quickly that, you know, it could be hard to keep up with them. So his idea for the AT was fundamentally not about the trail itself, but about these small rustic communities that would be built along the ridgeline, and the trail would just be there to connect them. The heart of his proposal were these communities that would have a small population that lived year round, but they would be places to learn about handcrafts and living in a different way, living in a closer connection with the natural world around you. And they would provide a refuge for people from the eastern cities to come to for a week or 2 weeks at a time, you know, and learn about them, maybe contribute to, you know, whatever agricultural operation was there. So he had this vision, and he continued to have ideas that he lumped under this overall heading of regional planning. How do you plan the whole natural urban region as a single thing? His idea was, well, let's get the communities built and the trail will connect them. And to his frustration, to a certain extent, what people immediately latched onto was the trail for the trail's own sake as a hiking venue. And the larger social reform vision that he had fell by the wayside pretty quickly.
I want to talk about Myron Avery, who was from Maine, but we need to take a break. So we'll talk about that when we get back. I think a lot of our listeners probably have heard about Myron Avery. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or email talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Thomas College, committed to you and your success with flexible graduate programs online or on campus. thomas.edu/GPS. By Lake Stewards of Maine, celebrating 50 years of protecting Maine's lakes through citizen science. Learn how you can help at lakestewardsofmaine.org. And Folia, in Portland's Old Port, where you'll find jewelry by Maine designers as well as custom design and repair services. FoliaJewelry.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Akash Kapoor about utopias, the impulse to build a better world, and what happens when dreams crash against reality. He was raised in an experimental community in India, left for school in the U.S. at age 16, and later returned to raise his own family. His new book is Better to Have Gone: Love, Death, and the Quest for Utopia in Auroville. Join us.
And you can hear that tonight at 8 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is a media sponsor of the Midcoast Film Festival, hosted by the historic Lincoln Theater in Damariscotta. The festival features original films, long and short, narrative and documentary, that are based on true stories or events. The Midcoast Film Festival is happening July 23rd through the 25th. For complete details, please visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, our topic is the history of the Appalachian Trail. Joining me, Philip Denieri, who is the author of a new book, The Appalachian Trail, A Biography. Share your comments or questions by email at talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling. Post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Before we go to calls, though, we cannot not talk about Myron Avery. It's interesting, Phil, he is known as the father of the AT, and people know he's from Maine, but he was from Lubeck, nowhere near the current Appalachian Trail. Tell us about Avery.
Yeah, born and raised in North Lubeck, went to college at Bowdoin. During his summers at Bowdoin, he worked in the inland forests for the state's forestry service. And that seems to be when he got to know and got fascinated by the mountains. He went on to become a lawyer in Washington, D.C. for the federal government when he caught word of the AT project. And Avery was an intensely, incredibly driven individual. And once he heard about this AT project that was underway but was not rocketing along with progress, Benton Mackay was still in charge of it, but Mackay was kind of coming into and out of the project as he worked on other things. Avery basically over the course of a couple of years became the leader of the effort. Based in Washington, he organized the clubs and the activities to get the trail built in the southern half of the U.S. He started to sort of lead, sometimes in a way that was welcomed, sometimes in a way that wasn't, the efforts in the northern half of the trail. And among the many things that he accomplished, I mean, he determined where the trail would go. He went out and worked on the trail. He organized, he and the folks who typed letters for him just cranked out an incredible amount of letters to make things happen. But he was determined that the hardest part of the trail from Mount Washington in New Hampshire to Katahdin in Maine would get built. And it was only because of his intensity and his connection to the state and his connections within the state that, you know, we really got the initial version of the AT in Maine. The folks who climbed to the top of Katahdin and planted the very first version of the somewhat famous sign that says, you know, you're at the top of Katahdin and it's the northern end of the AT, was the first people were Myron Avery and three other men from Washington, D.C. The challenge of building the trail in Maine was that you didn't have the large cities like Boston and New York and Washington so close to it. So you didn't have a lot of people with time and money and cars on their hands to do the sort of like service projects that would get the trail built. If you hadn't had Avery, you certainly wouldn't have had the main section of the trail on the timeline that we did.
Sure. And a little bit of timing. I mean, throughout this book, it strikes me how the right timing has really been important. And it was the Civilian Conservation Corps. So if it were not the Great Depression, and if there were not such a thing as Civilian Conservation Corps, that final stretch that you talked about from North Conway to Katahdin may not have happened then.
Yeah. In fact, that very final section that was opened, a 2-mile stretch in Maine, was cleared by Civilian Conservation Corps workers. And they also did work on the southern part of the trail. There's a saying within the AT community, people who are familiar with its history, that it's a story of the right person coming along at the right time for the trail. And, you know, Benton Mackay was in many ways the right person to put the idea out there and get a lot of attention paid to it. Avery was the one to, you know, lead in that fierce way to get it built and then so on in the future. So yeah, the fact that the Civilian Conservation Corps was there was a key part of it. But it's important to remember that most of the construction of the trail in the first place and its construction and maintenance ever since has been done by volunteers in local trail clubs getting out there and doing their bit, you know, up and down this 2,200 mile long trail.
Which is part of the miracle of the trail, isn't it, really? That it's this a combination of overseen today by the National Park Service, but the real work is still done by volunteers in their local communities.
Yeah, the Park Service took responsibility for protecting the corridor of the trail where it wasn't already protected by a national forest, a national park, a state park. But they did so in partnership with the Appalachian Trail. It's now called the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. It was called the Appalachian Trail Conference. The ATC is the umbrella group for these individual local clubs. So you've got this place called the AT, which it's a place you can see on a map. It's an idea we can talk about, but it's got all these different owners of it, you know, the volunteers, the people who thru hike on it, the land managers for these different agencies who are responsible for it. And it provides this magnet of, you know, for people's good intentions and hard work, because it's such a fascinating concept for people, this trail that stretches over the ridgeline over all of this territory.
Another thing that I found, and I promise I'll go to calls after this, that I really found interesting about Myron Avery versus Benton McKay, even though McKay was a mentor really to Avery, they could not have come from a more different place. Benton McKay, very philosophical about the healing that people needed in our industrial world. And it seems like Avery couldn't even care about that. He didn't even seem that interested in nature, but he wanted a trail built.
Yeah. And they came to into serious conflict with one another and wound up not speaking to each other. Avery was just intensely committed to this idea of a through trail. It's marked, it's cleared, it's labeled, there are guidebooks about it, and it runs all the way from Maine to Georgia. The trail was the point for Avery. That was almost 180 degrees from McKay, for whom the philosophy was the point, and the trail would get built slowly over time as people got on board with the larger project. Diametrically opposed visions of you know, how it would work. And in the tension between the two, you get today's AT. It still has this tension, but also these different aspects of it's a right-of-way that has to be protected and maintained, but it's also a place for these, you know, higher aspirations and goals.
I'll go to Patricia, who's calling from St. George, Maine. Hi, Patricia, go ahead.
I will be getting this book. And anybody that cannot walk the trail through trail or cannot walk it at all, they need to get Grandma Gatewood's Walk. I've talked to you about this before, Jennifer. Fabulous book. Woman who started walking it in her 60s, I believe. She walked it many times. And she started when it was just a little path. And she was on the trail when that hurricane hit that you were speaking about. And another great book about it is, I think it's Bill Bryson, A Walk in the Woods.
Patricia, I'm so glad you brought those both up, because Phil talks about those in his book and the role that both Grandma Gatewood and Bill Bryson played in really capturing the imagination, how they both played such an important role in capturing the imagination of the American public when it came to the Appalachian Trail. Why don't we take them one at a time, Philip? Grandma Gatewood, who was she and why was her journey so important?
Emma Grandma Gatewood was 67 when she thru-hiked the trail in the mid-1950s. And the first person generally recognized as through hiking was a man named Earl Schaefer, who had completed it in 1948. So Schaefer, fits in some ways the sort of standard narrative I think many people might hold about the trail. A young male loner who finds himself and sets himself on course for the rest of his life. Grandma Gatewood didn't tick any of those boxes. She had led a very difficult working class life. She was married to a violently abusive husband for years. But in her 60s, her kids were grown. She was from Appalachia herself. She had grown up in southeastern Ohio, right across the river from West Virginia. She had a different idea of what nature was. It wasn't a place for people reflecting on the meaning of life to, you know, get away and restore themselves. She grew her family's food in concert with the land that she lived on. And so she's a grandmother. She's in her 60s. She's finally free of this husband. Her kids are grown. And she says, with my free time, I want to walk in the woods in a way where I don't have any other responsibilities. And I'm not going to escape to some highfalutin nature that I'm going to philosophize about. As I walk, I'm going to meet people and maybe stay on their farms and make use of their hospitality if they want to extend it to me. She saw the trail and the built, lived-in environment around her as all one thing, as opposed to this separate space that we go to. Gatewood's story has become much better known in recent years because of the book that your caller mentioned, Grandma Gatewood's Walk, which I cite in my book. That's the first book that the story of Grandma Gatewood was out there. The fact of the life that she had led and the violence that she had survived only came to light with that book within the past few years. And understandably, Grandma Gatewood's story has become one that people are very interested in.
Mm. And with Bill Bryson's A Walk in the Woods, a lot of people in the trail community weren't a big fan of that book at first.
Yeah, and many still aren't. Bryson wrote his book in 1998. He was a very successful writer, mostly in the vein of humorous travel narratives, sharply observant, hilarious in places, definitely a sarcasm that works better for some audiences than for others. He had not had, though, a bestseller in the U.S. He was born in the U.S. He had lived most of his adult life in Britain, where he was a popular author. Had moved back here with his family for a short while, wrote a book about hiking the AT that started off as a thru-hiking narrative. He determined that wasn't going to work, but he wrote this book where the trail was at the center of the story in terms of the things that he wrote about, but it really provided a launching pad for him to do what Bryson does best, which are these humorous asides and these pieces of humor writing that, like great humor, A, they're funny and enjoyable to read, but B, they say something interesting and valuable about the world. So he wrote a Bill Bryson book using the AT. It was not the type of book that insiders in the AT community were used to or particularly fond of, where one hikes the trail, they hike every foot of it, they sing its praises as a place of natural renewal. So to me, the interesting thing about Bryson, and he's only recently retired from writing these incredibly popular books, is that it shows how by the late 1990s, this trail that had been a project for a relatively few people, relatively unto themselves in the first part of the 20th century, by the end of the 20th century, it's a well-known enough place and it's a fixture in the American landscape that he could write that kind of book and have it be a bestseller. It is a bestseller to this day. It's just and for most people, many people, if you mention the Appalachian Trail, the first thing you hear from them is Bill Bryson's A Walk in the Woods. That book, interestingly, is the trail in some ways, for some folks. If you're an insider of the AT community, you've thru-hiked it, you've done hours of backbreaking labor to protect it. The idea that this outsider loafs in and hikes not very much of the trail, and then his book becomes the one that everybody identifies with the trail, you can understand how there could be some friction there.
And both Grandma Gatewood and Bill Bryson and others reflect different answers to a question that you sort of ask throughout the book, which is, who is the Appalachian Trail for? And that is still kind of unresolved, isn't it?
Yeah, it you know, I think any place or any idea that's as attractive as the AT is going to be attractive because different people find it suits their interests or passions or ambitions for different reasons. So, you know, we talked earlier about the early 1900s Back to Nature movement and this writer, Horace Kephart. To him, to be in the outdoors was to make your mark. You caught your own food, you chopped down trees, you built shelter for yourself. 180 degrees from today, where our goals would be to leave no trace whatsoever. So that's just one example of how what we're after when we go to these trails. Are we after fitness? Are we trying to set a record of some kind? Are we trying to escape from the world and find ourselves? Are we trying to actually connect with the world in a deeper way? Different people are getting different things out of it. Many people want to, understandably, as quickly as they can, get to whatever scenic view is available so they can see the view and then move on from there. So there's no way that you can't have different ambitions and different uses and therefore some conflict about it. And among the many services that the National Park Service and the volunteers in the Appalachian Trail, the volunteers and the professionals in the Appalachian Trail Conservancy do, is they manage and they moderate these different uses, and they try to figure out what's the best way to make this space work for the most people in the most protective ways. And it's a tough job to do.
Patricia, thanks for your call. We do need to go to another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about a new book about the Appalachian Trail by Philip Denary. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from New England Naturopathic Health, focused on individually oriented and minimally invasive health care. NaturopathicME.com and Libby & Son U-Picks in Limerick, with pick your own blueberries, blueberry donuts, smoothies, and live music. LibbySonUPicks.com.
I'm Don Gagne. The pandemic has shifted a lot of things, and for many people, that includes what they wear and the way they engage with their clothes.
All of these changes in the workplace, in the way that we socialize, have really meant a sense of liberation for people to dress in a way that feels true to yourself.
Post-pandemic fashion. Next time on Here and Now.
Stay tuned. That's coming up shortly after Maine Calling from 12 noon until 2 here on Maine Public Radio. Are you ready to explore Maine this summer? Maine Public wants to help. Our Summer Breeze Selfie Challenge will direct you to fun spots throughout vacation land. We've placed Summer Breeze signs from Wells to Presque Isle. Simply take a selfie in front of a Summer Breeze sign, post it to social media using the hashtag SummerBreezeME, and you'll be entered into a drawing to win some great summer prizes. Visit MainePublic.org for all the details, or stop by a service plaza on the Maine Turnpike and pick up your Summer Breeze location finder.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to Maine Calling, and today we're talking about the stories behind the making of the Appalachian Trail. My guest is Philip Denary. He's the author of The Appalachian Trail, a biography. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. And be quick to get your question in before the end of the program. We'll go to Mark, who's calling from Standish. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Good morning. How are you?
Great.
My story is kind of complex in that my grandfather, Horace Hildreth, was friends with Benton MacKay. They attended Harvard College together and became friends when my grandfather suffered an accident in a chemistry experiment and lost his vision for a few months. And Benton read his studies for him, and they became friends for life. They hiked together in the summer, I believe it was, of 1901, the Green Mountains from Massachusetts to Canada. And it was on that hike of about 3 weeks duration that I think it was atop Stratton Mountain that they had the vision of one trail connecting all the mountaintops from Georgia to Maine. I think after that hike, they lost about 30 pounds each, and they spent the next 3 weeks principally eating. That's what I was told. I met Benton in, must have been 1972. He was living in Shirley, Massachusetts, where he had made his home for years. And he had two houses there. One had no power at all. And that's the one that he chiefly resided in the wintertime. At that point, he had lost most of his vision and he was hard of hearing. And I was just a lad in high school, and I made a photograph of him at the time. But I have many stories.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for calling in. Philip, you look thrilled.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating to hear. Mackay was near the end of his long life by 1972. He was 96, I want to say, Mackay was when he died. And the story of him and Horace Hildreth and their hike together in Vermont, you can imagine, is you know, central to Appalachian Trail history and lore. I guess the other thing I should point out is that is this town that he lived in, Shirley, Massachusetts, Shirley Center, he referred to it. So a village within the larger town of Shirley. It was the place where Mackay formed his almost utopian ideas about how the world was supposed to work. So Mackay spent most of his growing up years in New York City, some in Washington. And the family had this cottage that they had bought for themselves as a way to get away from the big city. Actually, one of Mackay's older brothers bought it for the family. It became a place to escape to, and then he lived, you know, large chunks of his life there. But it was this little village to him with a perfect town common at the center, and then homes, and then small farm plots, and then the wilderness beyond. And what he was trying to do with the AT, in some respects, was to recreate in his mind this perfect balance between wilderness and then sustainable development and then small towns that work in harmony with their surroundings. And it all came from this place, Shirley Center. There is an excellent biography of Benton Mackay. The title of the book is Benton Mackay, M-A-C-K-A-Y-E, written by Larry Anderson. It's the authoritative biography. Mackay is a really interesting character, and I strongly recommend Anderson's biography of him.
And Mark, I want to ask you about your grandfather, Horace Hildreth. How did he feel about the Appalachian Trail and what it had become later in his life?
Well, they corresponded for years, and they just talked about the places they'd been together, and it was amazing in my grandfather's lifetime, and he related to Benton watching an entire forest cycle in certain areas of land. Where they grew up, they were just fields, and then they were mature forests when they were old.
Did he like what it had become? Did he appreciate that not only did that vision come to reality, but the way in which it was used?
Indeed.
Yeah.
A gift to us all.
Yeah, it's interesting what Mark says about the full cycle that the forest went through. You know, so many wooded areas, forested areas of New England nowadays are forests that have been built upon cleared land, cleared for agricultural usage, cleared for timber usage. So the idea that the landscape could recover in that way, and that what Mackay would call the metropolitan, the always oozing out urban manufacturing world, the idea that we could, in some places at least, hold it back and let the land do what it would otherwise do, that's a huge success. And it was not at all obvious to them in the early 1900s that that would have been possible.
Mark, thank you so much. Yeah, go ahead.
Has he read Expedition 9?
I have not read Expedition 9. That's the you're talking about the Mackay's own book that he wrote when he was a boy.
Mackay's Reflections. Yes.
Yeah. Mark, thank you so much for calling in. I do want to use Mark calls, though, Philip, to talk about something else that's, of course, part of the heritage of the trail. Our caller, Mark, mentions that his grandfather and Benton McKay met at Harvard, which, you know, for that era, a very small number of people went to any college at all, much less Harvard. And the legacy of the Appalachian Trail, with some exceptions like a Grandma Gatewood, is really a legacy of middle, upper middle class white men and their view of what a perfect utopian world would be. And that would be one with a trail for wilderness to get away from their urban lives.
Yeah, in that respect, the story of the AT is not all that different from the story of national parks in general, and really the whole land preservation movement of the 20th century, in that it was a project that was organized and populated by and responsive to the worldviews and the needs of a fairly narrow slice of the population. So, we mentioned Myron Avery. Now, Myron Avery did not come from a very wealthy background. He had to work his summers to go through Bowdoin, but he went to Bowdoin, and then he went to Harvard Law, and Benton McKay went to Harvard. And the folks who had the time on their hands and the vehicles, when that wasn't a common thing to have, to go off and take these trips and do the trail work, you know, obviously we're a pretty well-off segment of society. So one of the tensions that you have with the AT, again, with a lot of places in this category, are that on the one hand, they seem, what attracts us to them is that they're natural. They're not social, they're not urban, they're not in the news. It's just rocks and trees and mountains, and thank heavens it's a way to escape from all of that. Well, yeah, but the fact that those places are protected, and which ones are protected, and what it takes to get to them and use them, actually was cooked up by a pretty narrow slice of the population. And that's less true today than it once was. The Park Service and the ATC and people of their own volition are changing the nature of the trail and who uses it and who gets what out of it. But something like, who is the trail for and how are we going to manage it? Is the trail only for the serious outdoors person who requires a lot of gear and know-how to be able to use it safely? If you answer the question that way, well, then that means that you're selecting as your audience who gets served by the trail, those who come from a background and have the money to have that training and to have that gear. Do you instead define it? Yeah, and the time, is it a more widely available thing, more open to the general public? Well, if so, then does that mean that the parking lots near the trail are bigger? Does that mean that you've made what would have been a rigorous, challenging hike much more smooth and easy for people? These are the tensions that folks have to figure out.
We'll go to Roderick, who's calling from North Conway, New Hampshire. Hi, Roderick. Go ahead.
Hi there. Yeah. First, I want to congratulate the author for correctly naming the terminal mountain in Maine. It is Katahdin, not Mount Katahdin. The Katahdin is a anglicizing of Indian words, Katahdin, which means greatest mountain. So if you call it Mount Katahdin, you're saying Mount Greatest Mountain, which doesn't say very much. Anyway, I've done the trail almost four times. My last time I quit in Dalton, Massachusetts, and discovered that the fire was out of the belly. I had done it. My trail name was Chronic Fatigue Syndrome. You might want to comment, Mr. Author, about trail names. They're a very interesting phenomenon.
Sure.
Everyone has a trail name. Okay. Yeah. So back to you.
So a couple things. Yeah. So trail names are the convention for through hikers. When one through hikes the trail, one takes on often a one word trail name that they go by while they're on the trail. It's one of many parts of the through hiking subculture, which again, I'm not terribly conversant in. I'm not a through hiker, and I don't pretend to know that world inside and out, but it's an indicator of how committed and passionate that community is, a thriving life online and communication with one another, that this thru-hiking community in some ways has its own ownership of the trail, not in legally, not in terms of how it's managed, but it's a somewhat exclusive club that you have to work really hard to get into and endure a lot of time and a lot of physical hardship to call yourself a thru hiker. And that's an important part of the AT community. I always want to stress to people that there are an estimated more than 3 million people who set foot on the AT each year, and only a tiny fraction of them are thru hikers. So as interesting as that community is, and as important as it is to the life and the meaning of the Appalachian Trail, it's for the rest of us as well. The other thing I would say about Katahdin is that, Katahdin, one of the very first people to hike to the top of Katahdin was Henry David Thoreau, who had a very famous sort of epiphany about the natural world and how welcome it was while he was up there. So, Katahdin, and as the northern terminus of the AT, and the stretch of the AT that is in Maine, are, so unique in the overall context of the trail. Now, any state would say, understandably, well, in Virginia, we've got the Blue Ridge, and in New Jersey, we've got this. And of course, that's all true. But the wilderness experience in Maine, the remoteness, the centrality of Katahdin to the folklore of the trail, all make the Maine AT, really a unique place in the larger context.
Robert and Dixmont, we're almost out of time, so if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Oh, I'll be quick. I'm curious to know your thoughts on how the Conservancy handled the whole COVID issue and closed down parts or all of the trail to thru-hikers.
I would say two things. First of all, I'm a big fan of the ATC in general. I think they've got a difficult job. They are committed professionals and a massive volunteer community, and they've got to make tough calls. So my first response would be, if that's what the ATC thought was wise and necessary, then probably the correct thing to do. The other thing I would say is, we want to think of the AT as a piece of nature separate from the rest of the world. And so, we need it as a getaway. Probably the one year that anybody who even thought about thru hiking would most want to do it would be last year. But look, it's national forest land, it's national park land, it has to be managed, it has to be planned. There's a whole lot of many aspects of the AT that make it a facility. It's a piece of recreational infrastructure. Now, nobody runs off to the woods to think about recreational infrastructure. They run off to, so I understand why there was so much controversy over that and so many people so upset about not being able to make this important journey. But in the end, it's a part of the rest of the world. And if other places were closed because of COVID, it didn't surprise me, and it didn't strike me as the wrong call that the AT needed to be closed to thru hikers.
Robert, thanks so much for your call, and you will be the last call this hour. And thank you for joining us today. Phil Denary is a lecturer at the University of Michigan and the author of The Appalachian Trail, a biography. Philip Denary, thank you so much for being on Maine Calling.
Thanks very much for having me. It was very enjoyable.
Today's sound engineer, Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Today's program will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. Tomorrow on the program, we will wrap up the legislative session in Augusta, what was and wasn't accomplished. Legislators are meeting for the last day, we think, today. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.